the federal budget, Planet America, and some good news. Welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I'm your host, Ben Davison, and with me, as always, is the lovely, the Japanese learning, the guardian columnist extraordinaire and puppy cuddler, Van Badham.
Good morning, Van. Konnichiwa, Benjamin.
Konnichiwa. So, here we are. The Week on Wednesday, episode 8. Episode 7 was the biggest episode we've had so far.
And thank you, everyone, for the support. It's such a crazy thing. Ben and I do this show from our shed with our dog on a Wednesday, and you're tuning in, and that's fantastic.
So thanks, everyone, very, very much.
So let's get right into it, Benjamin. The federal budget. So this was a big spending budget from a coalition of the Liberal and National Party, who once condemned the Australian Labor Party for a debt and deficit disaster that rescued us from the GFC. As was pointed out by Lee Sales last night, that at the time that the Liberals were screaming blue murder about Labor running up a $54 billion deficit, now it's a decade later, they have run up a $250 billion deficit. It is four times what they condemned Labor for. My second figure may be wrong, but four times is definitely the amount. But Josh Frydenberg says that Lee Sales is just being cynical talking about it. What is going on? Why are they spending so much money? What are they spending money on?
Well, let's be really clear about the debt component first. So the debt component will get out to $1 trillion. That's actually where it will get to in the budget forecasts. So this year is a $250 billion deficit. And what we can expect to see is the big spending to continue. The thing that is really hypocritical here is that the Morrison-Frydenberg government is claiming that this is all about temporary and targeted, and that what happened before under Labor was baking in spending. Well, what Frydenberg and Morrison are doing is actually baking in cuts. So they're baking in tax cuts, they're baking in instant asset write-off tax cuts for business. So they're actually baking in huge amounts of debt that get us up to $1 trillion in the medium term. The budget is a really incredible mix of core Liberal Party trickle-down ideology with some attempts to sweeten up the electorate through what you might consider more Keynesian-style economics.
And Keynesian, of course, means we spend to create infrastructure. Infrastructure adds value while it creates jobs. That's a very basic understanding of Keynesianism, which was, of course, the economic philosophy that got us out of the Great Depression.
But, of course, like all things the Liberals do, when their heart's not in it, it's completely half done. So a lot of the infrastructure announcements last night had already been announced. There was very little new money in that approach. But I really want to focus on some of the wage subsidy tax elements, because this is where there's a lot of focus from the government trying to convince people that what they're doing is helping ordinary people, ordinary Australians. You might remember in March, the government was opposed to any form of wage subsidy. Then, of course, they brought in JobKeeper. They didn't put proper protections in place. We've talked about that in previous episodes. Check all that out, because there's a lot of detail there that we're just not going to have time to get into today. But needless to say, they've half-baked a bunch of new wage subsidy programs as well. The first I'll talk about is the apprenticeship scheme, where they're saying they'll provide a 50% wage subsidy for the first year for 100,000 apprentices. Now, that's temporary. Yep, absolutely. But let's see how positive that temporary measure is when apprentices try and go into their second year. And for those who actually do get kept on in their second year, let's see how many get kept on in their third. Because if you're an employer in this economic climate, going into a second year with an apprentice who suddenly costs you twice as much is going to be very, very difficult. Now, remember, the budget makes it really clear that unemployment will not recover to pre-pandemic levels until after 2024. So there's still a long, long road for economic recovery here. There's no, oh, well, employers will just be able to carry that extra apprentice at the full rate. That's not what people think will actually be a reality. Even the budget makes that really, really clear. The other new wage subsidy is what they're calling Job Maker. Now,
I've heard this before. Haven't we had Job Maker? We've had Job Keeper, Job Helper,
Job Builder.
Somebody made a joke. Dan Illick made a joke about the Seagrass announcement last night, saying it was Job Kelper.
It's just slogan after slogan with this government. Now, this program is supposed to help young people get out of unemployment. Now, the reality of this economic crisis that we're in because of the pandemic and because of the way Morrison and Frydenberg botched their initial response is that women over 45 have been most impacted. Now, you would think that if women over 45 are the most impacted, a government program around jobs would focus on helping those people back into work. Job Maker doesn't do that at all. Job Maker is a youth wage subsidy program where an employer will get $200 a week for people aged between 16 and 29 who have been on a government payment in at least one of the last 3 months, who they employ for at least 20 hours a week. And if you're between 30 and 35 and meet those same criteria, the employer can get $100 a week. Now, there's all sorts of perverse incentives in this now, right? Because if you're an employer who is going to hire somebody full-time, you've now been incentivized to hire somebody part-time. Now, part-time work is less stable, it provides less income for someone. Now, there's no extra money for the worker, right, who might have got full-time work and is now going to get part-time, but there's an extra money for the employer, for the business. And of course, if you're over 35, if you just turned 36 on Monday, then you're completely out of the reckoning. You know, there is a hard cutoff here that we'll see hundreds of thousands of unemployed people, particularly those most impacted, women over 45, remember, completely cut out of the program and made it even harder for them to return to work. And we know older people struggle to get back into the workforce. There's a whole range of age discrimination effects that take place that make it hard for women and older people.
So I just want to raise one thing. So on Q&A on Monday night, the lovely Jane Hume, and I do use the word lovely quite ironically there, was talking about how great it was that her government, the Liberal government, had allowed people to take out all of their superannuation savings to pay their own way through the impact of the pandemic. Now, we know there's a structural problem with superannuation because of patterns of work that women experience and various inbuilt discriminations and gender pay gaps and things, that women retire with a lot less superannuation than men. We now have a whole generation of Australians who've wiped out the superannuation savings in order to keep themselves financially viable through the pandemic. And this same group of people who are already structurally marginalised with the superannuation system, which is women over 45, who have lower amounts of savings, who might have wiped them out, are now the ones that there are structural disincentives to employing in the economy.
Absolutely.
Oh, great. Fantastic. So unrelated, the single largest growing group of Australia's homeless is women over 45. Amazing.
Well, let's get into that too, because there's another kick in the guts there for women, because homelessness services were cut by $40 million in this budget. So this is a budget that really does punish women, and particularly older women, in a really substantial way. One of the sweeteners in the budget, if you like, was bringing forward tax cuts to try and convince people that the government cares. Of course, if you don't have a job, tax cuts are worthless to begin with. And we know that women generally are earning less in the economy. And these tax cuts are skewed towards the high-income earners. I'm going to give you some figures here, because this really demonstrates what this budget does and how it advantages those who already are comfortable over those who are struggling. Keeping in mind, if you don't have a job, you get nothing from the tax cut. If you're on $65,000 a year, this year you'll get $1,080 saving on your tax. Next year, you get zero. The year after, $500. Now, if you're on $165,000 a year, now, keep in mind that most people on that kind of income are men. You will get $2,430 this year, $2,430 next year, and $7,455 the year after. Now, these are not in any way proportional. This is in no way going to help low-income earners in the same way that it helps high-income earners. And we
but
know
why do high-income earners need help?
Well, they don't, and that's the point, because we know high-income earners have used this time to save money. Australia's household savings ratio has increased massively, and that basically just means more people who have money are saving money, whereas people who don't have money, we know, spend all their money because they have no choice. You know, if you're on a low-income, you know you've got to spend your money just to survive. If you've got a lot of money, you're putting money away. And that's all this is going to do. So women are women who are impacted, over 45, are missing out on the wage subsidy program to help apparently help younger people get into jobs. They've had cuts to homelessness services, which we know older women are most likely to need. There's still nothing in there to improve their superannuation outcomes. And of course, the tax cuts will disproportionately give men on higher incomes a better outcome. And let's look at the cost of those tax cuts. That's $18 billion. This is what I mean about what I said before around this sort of this idea that it's temporary just isn't true. This is baking in costs to the budget. It's cuts. This means cuts to the money that's available to spend on programs, healthcare, education, roads funding,
universities.
Universities. And the universities are already copping it now. You know, Frydenberg was very clear that once unemployment gets down to 6%, now that's almost a million people unemployed, they're going to start budget repair, which means cuts. You know, they're going to cut services at 6% unemployment. That's more than three times what the unemployment rate was when there was a full employment policy in Australia. So this is not a budget that's about jobs or about helping people get into work. It's actually what comes next that this budget is about, and that's about giving money to business. Now, the tax cuts to individuals, $18 billion. The value of tax cuts to business is almost twice that. It's about $34 billion. And a huge chunk of it is going into what's called instant asset write-offs. This means that if you're a business with less than $5 billion in turnover, 99% of businesses, you can write off your investments this year against your tax.
What kind of investments?
Oh, a car, piece of machinery, you know, essentially anything that's created as an asset. Now, there's no strings to this. It doesn't have to be Australian made. It doesn't have to be built here, constructed here. It can be, this was described as really great news for Chinese factory owners because they're going to get a lot of business out of this. Now, we'd like to see that kind of a program have strings attached.
So local procurement. For people who haven't come across this term, local procurement just means an obligation to buy these things from Australian businesses. So we talk a lot about a need for Australian made because Australian made means Australian employed, Australian jobs, Australian activity in the economy. If we were tying an instant asset write-off to local procurement Australian made products, that'd be great. That would be a form of encouraging the economy and encouraging new businesses, encouraging, you know, localised manufacturing for whatever a business could possibly want. But we don't do that here. We make very few electrical appliances in Australia, like hardly any anymore. I think we're down to just a few wall ovens. Breville, who are an Australian company, don't even physically make their products in Australia anymore. You know, anything, or our car industry has gone. If you're buying cars, you're definitely buying them from overseas. But the government is happy to write that off with absolutely no encouragement for a market to be created for Australian companies to participate, innovate and be entrepreneurial. I love how they use the word entrepreneurial. Oh, we're going to be entrepreneurial. And their vision is basically being a delivery driver is entrepreneurial because if you've got an ABN, you're technically a small business, as opposed to actually creating market opportunities for, I hate explaining capitalism to capitalists. It really frustrates me.
It is really frustrating because we also know that what can happen is that companies can use this kind of a program to actually replace jobs, right? And in the short term, we may see some of that. We may see some jobs replaced by technology.
So you're talking about the government is actually creating an incentive to replace your job, Australia, with a machine.
Potentially.
A machine bought from China.
Potentially, yes.
Fantastic.
So between that and what's called a carry back losses provision, there's another $4.5 billion there, which basically means that if your company lost money between 2019 and now, you can claim losses against profits that you made from 2018 to now.
Which is what News Limited have always used in order to minimise their tax bills.
Well, normally what happens is if you've lost money in the past, you can use that against future profits. What this is saying is if you've made profits in the past, you can use future or current losses and claim against that. It's kind of reversing the standard the standard formula in a way. So,
oh, great!
So
business always wins.
So business will absolutely win. This is a great budget if you're a large business. If you're a large business, you've just got access to a huge pool of money that you didn't have access to before, with no strings. Let's be clear. The only thing that has any strings is that youth wage subsidy program. And again, there are issues all over that around labor rights, around encouraging insecure work. It hasn't been made clear if people will be protected by the Fair Work Act. There's no engagement with the union movement on that, of course. Like it's a really shady program, at the same time as this huge pool of money, twice what they're putting into personal tax cuts, is just made available, essentially strings free. These are not job creating programs. You know, the Treasury estimates that there'll be 1 million jobs created over 4 years. That's not really a great outcome. People go, oh, that 1 million jobs sounds like a lot. Let's be clear about that. The trend is about 1 million every 4 or 5 years anyway, right? That's what our economy creates anyway. So all of this money, all of this debt, all of these programs is really just to get us to trend. Now, there's nothing in the budget around childcare, which many, many economists begged the government to put in place. That would have facilitated women's participation in the economy. That would have created productivity that gave women a better outcome.
And also created better educational opportunities, yes, for children in the long run, because we know countries that have more early childhood education have better health and, yes, economic and wellbeing outcomes over the long run when children grow up.
You know, social housing was mentioned in the budget speech in terms of providing concessional loans. Now, that's not funding social housing. That's giving developers cheap access to money. It's not the same thing. And lots of participants in social housing have said there's nothing in it for social housing. And again, that was the number one thing economists said the government could do to improve the economy.
Was to have construction-led recovery by the government commissioning social housing, and to have a productivity increase that assisted women to get back to work, and also had wellbeing outcomes by introducing childcare, which is obviously a huge job creator as well, because it can be localised and people, I mean, it's just so frustrating, because as we both know, this is just more of the same Liberal Party neoliberal trickle-down economics that we've seen fail across the world for 40 years. It's the same idea that if business just gets richer and the stock market is booming, well, that's what an economy is. And of course, the wealth never trickles down. It never does.
As I say, these are going to bake in costs for ordinary people in terms of service cuts, in terms of having to find ways to pay this off, at the same time as doing exactly what you just said, giving money to business. It's a really disappointing budget when you actually get under the hood and have a look. There's a lot of surface talk about tax cuts, and for some people that will seem really attractive. I can understand that. It seems like money in your pocket straight away. But don't forget, there are still cuts to JobKeeper. There are still cuts to JobSeeker. So I think Jim Chalmers said, you know, for an average currently employed worker, you'll get $50 back, but you'll lose $300 from JobKeeper. That's not a good trade-off.
Just look at a Trojan horse budget, which is literally about structuralising inequality, that if you're not doing well now, you've missed the ship, because the treasures and the favours are all going to those who are already doing well. And for people who've been absolutely battered by coronavirus, and I look at people in our own community, the small businesses that have closed here, the people who've lost their jobs, older Australians who never thought they'd be unemployed, who lost their jobs, who are suddenly in this world of insecurity, well, there's nothing in that budget to help them.
No.
There's nothing to help them. You know, there are re-announcements. Tim Watts was on Twitter yesterday talking about all the money for intelligence security that was being promised. And he's like, I have literally run out of the times that they've made this announcement. And there are more like just nonsense paper over the cracks announcements, like the, what was it, the Women's Economic Development
Statement.
The women's, oh yes, and Marisa Payne, they're very useful. Marisa Payne is going to make an announcement, you know, about this, and this is going to be so great for encouraging women's entrepreneurialism and the rest of it. And it's $240 million. There are almost 6 million women in the Australian workforce, and I did the numbers, and this basically works out to $40 every assistance each. Yeah. For what exactly? Like some pamphlets that, you know, like try and coax us into getting a retail super fund? Because that's sort of what I'm expecting. I mean, and that was the other thing to notice in the budget, was that they've got plans for super again, as they always have, the Liberals, some sneaky plan for super, and more will be revealed, which we know will be an attack on the industry super funds.
Absolutely.
Because they resent the fact the banks don't control them. And of course, the Liberal Party get rather a lot of money from the banks. So, yeah. Oh, God, sorry, I'm being a doomhead.
That's all right. Well, look, I just want to wrap this section up by just quickly mentioning the assumptions. So people might remember the last budget update that Josh Frydenberg gave. He made a whole bunch of assumptions about states reopening and not having any second waves. And of course, the very next day, there was an outbreak in Victoria, and we're still living through the repercussions of that. The assumptions in this budget are, once again, quite heroic. It assumes that all of the states will be reopened, except WA, by Christmas, and that WA will reopen essentially the day after the state election. So I don't know if he's just counting on a Liberal government getting in WA. But this sort of an assumption is also predicated on the idea that there'll be no second wave or third wave in Victoria.
Yeah, they're predicting in the budget that there will be a vaccine for coronavirus, despite the fact that humanity is yet to ever invent a vaccine for a coronavirus.
And it'll happen in the sort of first quarter of 2021.
How convenient.
It's crazy stuff, right? Like, it really makes, I think someone called them heroic assumptions. Now, that's just code for unrealistic assumptions. The slightest thing goes wrong in this budget, and that $1 trillion debt blows out massively. And the government will have to make decisions about whether it supports people or goes through with its fiscal plan. And sadly, I'm really concerned that what it will do is allow Australians to be left high and dry. So anyway,
well, because there's also, this is worth noting, there are two other things that really stuck out in the budget for me. One, there's no targeted spending towards renewable energy.
No.
And no willingness to create that industry of the future and give us a head start on the rest of the world and sort out our energy problems that would bring prices down and create jobs. That's not there. But also, there's no assumption of wage rises in the budget for the next 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, this government is not about working people. It's not about securing their employment. It's not about raising their wages. It's about giving money to business and letting business do what it wants. You know, this is a government that is making people like Jerry Harvey and Solomon Liu and Jim G. Isn't Eugenics on the Right Track mowing guy the middlemen for our economic recovery. And that is in itself a terrifying idea, because these people don't care. They want to make money. They want to make money, and they make a lot of money. So let's be really clear about this. This is a budget that's designed to look good, to give a couple of sweeteners, to make it seem like they're doing the right thing by you, when in fact they're not. And I wouldn't be surprised if we end up with an election pretty early in 2021.
Before the problems start.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway, that's the budget.
Well, that was happy news. Thanks for that, Ben.
Yeah, I'd really encourage people to try and get in under the hood on some of these issues, because this is the kind of thing where the government will spin really hard and a lot of the media will lap it up, because it's complex and it's tricky. But the detail is there, and the devil really is hiding in the detail.
And just for anyone who's listening, our account, Week on Wednesday on Twitter, we share a lot of resources from economists and think tanks and research outfits and people who, you know, we trust to be onto it. So you can always check our Twitter to see the kind of latest deep dive under the hood with these issues.
Absolutely. Now, Van, we're going to have an extended episode today, so tell us, what's going on in planet America?
I think the question is, Ben, what is not going on in planet America? I find it amazing that we did a show about the presidential debate a week ago, and it literally feels like a year ago, because so much has happened in that time, and it is just so implausible. And, you know, somebody said, you know, if you elect a game show host as a president, you get a game show. Yep. And that's what the whole world is living through at the moment. So very quickly, there were a number of revelations last week after the debate. One was that Biden comprehensively won it, like absolutely smashed it. 60% of Americans were like, yep, Trump is a bully. There have been reports of first-time voters turning up at polls because of the debate. And when I say first-time voters, I mean people in their 60s who've never voted before, who were so outraged by Trump's behaviour. But essentially, a number of things happened last week, and I'm trying to archive them all because they all happened fairly quickly around Thursday, Friday. So we found out, one, that there were tapes of Melania Trump effectively declaring war on Christmas, but with words that were far less polite.
Yeah.
And because of our agreement with Apple, I can't quote those, but you can certainly look them up on the internet. Melania Trump had a personal assistant who helped, you know, her run her operation. Mm-hmm. When something went wrong in Trump world, this woman was blamed for this massive disaster. This is early on in the administration. And knowing that Trump world had sold her out, this woman started taping her conversations with the First Lady and various other people, and she's dripping them out over the course of the next 4 weeks. And certainly Melania, who, you know, affects this image of being so charming, also said appalling things about the children kept in cages and her disinterest in Christmas. Christmas, the war on Christmas is obviously a Fox News trope about how all left-wingers are bad because you're not allowed to say Merry Christmas anymore. Well, I think they should probably speak to the First Lady about that because I love Christmas.
Yeah.
She doesn't.
We always
so
have
there
a Merry
was that.
Christmas here.
We also have a fraud investigation going on in the state of New York, mm-hmm. I believe, where Eric Trump, the slightly slower son, he has just pleaded the fifth, which is he's
right.
refusing to speak so as not to incriminate himself. Brad Pasquale, who used to be the national campaign director for the Trump campaign, who obviously screwed up the Tulsa event, the one at which Herman Cain, the Republican, caught coronavirus and subsequently died, that only 6,000 people came to. He brandished a gun at his partner and was arrested, tackled to the ground by police. How lucky he's white, so he lived. But he was voluntarily committed to a mental institution and has since started saying that he knows he's under investigation for campaign finance violations, which obviously carry federal terms in America. So there was that. Kimberly Guilfoyle, who is Donald Trump Jr.'s partner, she is also the head of fundraising for the Trump campaign. She used to be a Fox News host, and it was revealed in a story by The New Yorker that Kimberly Guilfoyle had to leave Fox because she was the subject of a enormous sexual harassment complaint from a young woman who was interning for her with accusations that were revealed in quite alarming detail about Kimberly Guilfoyle's behaviour, and a very large settlement was made and Kimberly ceased her employment there. So that's also going on. We also found out that there's a whistleblower complaint, another national security whistleblower complaint, because there's been political interference in intelligence reports that have been coming out of the FBI and the Department of Justice about election interference. So what the whistleblower has claimed is that Russian interference is extremely bad and the problems haven't been addressed since the 2016 election. But there haven't been interference attempts from Iran or China. But the Trump administration has been trying to make out that Iran and China are helping Joe Biden when there's actually no evidence to support this. So the whistleblower is like, this is political interference. And so that's, I mean, in another era, that would have been an impeachable
event. That's right.
People barely registered this. And then, of course, there were the investigators who have found a paper trail. We know, of course, So Donald Trump's tax returns were leaked to the New York Times. 20 years of them, he's been paying hardly any tax at all.
He's $750, I believe.
Yeah, that's the years he did pay tax. He paid $750, but mostly he's just been paying nothing.
Yeah.
His empire is an absolute sham. He's not the billionaire he made out to be on The Apprentice, which was, of course, the basis of his whole presidential persona. As it turns out, he owes hundreds of millions of dollars through loans that were facilitated through Deutsche Bank, and nobody knows who stumped up the money for those loans. Somebody has lent the President of the United States hundreds of millions of dollars, and nobody knows who, although these investigators have found that at the time Donald Trump took out the loans with the, that were facilitated by Deutsche Bank, a bank with links to the Kremlin made hundreds of millions of dollars of investments in that particular direction. So that all happened on the same day, all these different pieces of news.
Wow.
And it was sort of incredible. There's actually a phenomenon. The Washington Post are putting together an article about Americans who are not sleeping because they can't get off Twitter because the news is just so inherent. When all of this was going on, it was announced that Hope Hicks, who is one of the president's assistants, had tested positive for coronavirus. And within a couple of hours, of course, it was revealed that Trump himself and Milanoia had coronavirus. Since then, we've found out that effectively a Rose Garden party to celebrate Amy Coney Barrett, who is the right-wing extremist the Republicans are trying to rush onto the Supreme Court.
And we've talked about her.
Who we've talked about.
Too.
Yeah, so they had a party at the Rose Garden, and because they're all in denial about coronavirus and adamant that only weak men wear masks, and Trump even brought it up at the debate, you know, every time you see Joe Biden, he's wearing a mask. Well, Joe Biden doesn't have coronavirus, and not only does Donald Trump and his wife, but White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway, former governor of New Jersey and Trump debate prepper Chris Christie, Senator Tom Tillis, another couple of senators, all of whom are on the Judiciary Committee, the president of Notre Dame University who was there, all of these conservatives, they are dropping like flies. Since then, Kayleigh McEnany, who is the White House press spokesperson, she's been diagnosed with coronavirus. Today, it's come out Stephen Miller, who is the crazy right-wing racist who is Trump's speechwriter and seen as the architect of the worst racism of Trumpism. He's been diagnosed with coronavirus. They're dropping like flies. There was a revolt at the White House because the staffers in that building, which is an old, cramped building with very small contained quarters, they were like, nobody has told us about contact tracing. Nobody is taking any interest in our health. You know, cooks in the building are falling sick. Cleaners are falling sick. And then, of course, you had Trump raced off to Walter Reed, where all of these mysterious conflicting statements came out about how he had been given oxygen. He's on all these experimental medications. He's been pumped full of steroids that can make you psychotic. And he has effectively discharged himself. While he was still in hospital, apparently he threw a tantrum saying he wanted to go back to the White House. And the doctors negotiated to allow him to take a joyride around the block to see crazy Trump fans on the street in a car. And of course, the Secret Service car that he was in is sealed against chemical attack, meaning the Secret Service agents who drove him, who were in full germ warfare outfits, probably have coronavirus because he's highly contagious. Yesterday, he flies a helicopter and does this big press appearance, returning triumphantly to the White House, covered in makeup, looking as orange as a bloody Tahitian sunset. I've seen fewer colours in a Gauguin painting, and doing this whole, oh, don't let coronavirus dominate your life. 205,000 Americans are dead, 205,000 grieving families, and a man who pays $750 in tax gets the best healthcare in the world. But he's obviously sick as a dog, and you see the footage of him. He takes off his mask defiantly, and then he can't put the mask in his pocket.
Yeah.
He can't button up his jacket. He's clearly wheezing. He's clearly, you know, all these medical professionals on Twitter are like, it is outrageous that he was allowed to leave hospital. He is sick. He is contagious. Anybody who comes into contact with him is essentially risking their life. Yeah. And the message is he just doesn't care. And just in case you thought, oh my God, it can't get any crazier than this, today Trump announced, and this is before we even look at the photos of him working really hard in the White House, where he's literally signing blank pieces of paper for a photo shoot and photos taken within 10 minutes of one another in different rooms. He said that a $2.2 trillion rescue package that's supposed to be going through Congress to provide support to Americans who aren't billionaire reality TV show host presidents, he's going to block it. He's going to block it and doesn't think any aid should go through until after the election.
Well, I saw that he had instructed Mitch McConnell.
Take a breath.
I know. But I saw that he had instructed Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, to withdraw from the discussions with the Democrats about trying to pass this rescue package for American households. Now, that in itself is an extreme overreach from a president to instruct the leader of the Senate. They're supposed to have separation of powers there. Mm. They're supposed to be able to have these negotiations and then discuss with the president. He's, Stop doing that. Stop trying to save American households. Stop trying to save American business and focus on getting Amy Cohen Barrett put on the Supreme Court. That's what he's made the priority. I mean, that's an outrageous abuse.
It's so bonkers. And all these commentators today were like, if you were a Republican senator who was in a tight race, like Lindsey Graham, who is supposed to have one of the safest seats in the Senate in America because he's the senator from South Carolina, South Carolina, deep red, is in trouble. Like the Democrat slayed Graham in a debate the other night. And commentators were saying, like, these are people who need to promise money to their electorates. Like, they need to have funding and because of the economic fallout of coronavirus, the economy is in desperate trouble. And Trump refusing to hand out the goodies. It's like the man doesn't even understand pork barreling.
Yeah.
And this is the thing, you know, you elect a non-politician, you get non-political outcomes, which are bad for people.
Yeah.
But on top of this, there was another scandal just on the way from the house to the shed where we record this show, is that now it's come out that the Trump-appointed CIA director is trying to push this story about how Hillary Clinton was campaigning to spread negative stories about Trump and interference in 2016. And the previous CIA director who wrote those comments wrote them in the context of saying there is a Russian disinformation campaign that is saying Hillary Clinton is doing these things. And the Trump administration has done a copy and paste, and declassified these reports in order to raise the Hillary specter from the dead. It is totally out of control. The disease is on the rise in America again. Thousands and thousands of cases a day. The economy is an absolute disaster. The stock market's crashed when they found out that this rescue money wouldn't be going through. And yet we're all there posing around a diseased, infected man covered in orange makeup who thinks he's reenacting scenes from Apocalypse Now. It is like totally... Oh, my God.
Wow. Okay. So that's full on. That is so much to process. And we are just running out of time here. We have gone over, but we have to end on a good news note, Van, because
the last two
segments were just way too much.
So two things. One, there was mention made in the budget about rehabilitating Australia's mangroves.
Yep.
And for a environmental vandal government, that's actually a good thing because mangroves are one of the most powerful carbon capture systems. That's great. And the other happy news is John and Patricia McCloskey, who were the crazy white people from St. Louis, Missouri, who pointed guns at Black Lives Matter protests and then were invited by Trump to speak at the Republican National Convention, and they're obviously just, you know, extremist right-wing loons. Well, they've been indicted by a grand jury and facing charges, including evidence tampering. So they may lose their law licenses, could even go to jail. That's made me really happy.
Yeah. So don't go waving assault rifles at peaceful protesters. That's probably a good lesson there. Wow. So this was one of the most full-on action-packed episodes we've ever had. Thank you so much for listening in today. That is the end of the week on Wednesday. You can reach us...
Not forever, just for this week.
You can reach us at Gmail, theweekonwednesday@gmail.com. You can reach us on Facebook, The Week on Wednesday. You can reach us on Twitter, Week on Wednesday.
And you should subscribe, and you should encourage other people to subscribe, because every time you do, Ben gets an alert and he goes, ooh, and it's cute.
So thank you so much for listening. Tune in next week. Fanny, love you.
I love you too.
Bye.